This content is AI-generated for informational purposes only and should not be directly used for clinical decision-making.
Hello, and welcome back to the Neurosurgery Hub podcast. I'm Dr. Aris, senior attending here, and today we're diving into a topic that every spine surgeon and resident thinks about daily, the optimization of post-operative recovery.
And I'm Dr. Alara. Today we're looking at a fascinating new study from the journal BMC Anesthesiology, published in 2026. It's a randomized controlled trial coming out of Ains Shams University that addresses a critical gap in our clinical practice: how to best manage postoperative pain after elective lumbar fusion operations.
Right. We all know that postoperative pain management in spine surgery is notoriously challenging. If we don't get it right, we're looking at poor recovery, prolonged opioid use, delayed ambulation, and ultimately an extended length of hospital stay. It's the cornerstone of the Enhanced Recovery After Surgery, or ERAS, protocols we've been trying to implement.
Exactly, Dr. Aris. The study notes that while ERAS protocols aim for a multimodal, opioid-sparing approach, there really isn't a gold standard for pain control after spine surgery yet. This trial specifically compared two major players: the ultrasound-guided erector spinae plane block, or ESPB, and intrathecal morphine, which we refer to as ITM.
These are two very different approaches. For the residents listening, remember that ESPB involves injecting a local anesthetic into the fascial plane deep to the erector spinae muscle. It's gained a lot of traction recently because it's relatively easy to apply and has a high safety profile. On the other hand, ITM has been around for a long time. Morphine is a hydrophilic opioid, so it stays in the cerebrospinal fluid longer, providing coverage for about 24 hours.
And that longevity is the big selling point for ITM. However, as the paper points out, ITM is often limited by dose-dependent side effects like nausea, vomiting, pruritus, and the one we all fear, respiratory depression. This study really wanted to see if the safety and ease of the ESPB could match or beat the efficacy of a 0.2 milligram dose of ITM.
Let's look at the study design. It was a randomized controlled trial with 120 patients. They were all ASA physical status 1 or 2, aged between 21 and 55, undergoing elective lumbar spine fusion.
They divided them into three groups of 40. Group E received the bilateral ultrasound-guided ESPB. Group M received the 0.2 milligram intrathecal morphine, and group C was the control group. All of them were under general anesthesia, and they were all pre-medicated with 4 milligrams of intravenous ondansetron to help with potential nausea.
Now, the primary outcome they were looking at was the time to first rescue analgesic, which in this study was ketorolac. What did they find, Alara?
The results were quite clear. Both the ESPB group and the ITM group had a significantly longer duration until that first rescue analgesic compared to the control group. In fact, both intervention groups saw a reduced total analgesic consumption within the first 24 hours postoperatively.
But there was a distinction between the two, wasn't there?
Yes. When they looked at the pain scores at the 24-hour mark, group the intrathecal morphine group, actually had lower pain scores and lower overall analgesic demands than the ESPB group. So in terms of pure analgesic horsepower, the ITM 0.2 milligram dose outperformed the block.
That's a crucial point for the surgeons listening. While the ESPB is effective, it might not provide the same depth of analgesia as neuralaxial morphine. But of course, that efficacy comes at a price. What did the side effect profile look like?
That's where the trade-off happens. The M group had significantly higher rates of nausea and pruritus, itching, compared to both the ESPB group and the control group. The paper mentions that these side effects were manageable, but they were definitely more prevalent.
Did they see any of the more severe complications? Any respiratory depression?
Interestingly, no. There were zero cases of respiratory depression in this study. The authors suggest that the 0.2 milligram dose might be a sweet spot, where you get the 24-hour coverage without crossing into that dangerous territory of respiratory compromise. They also use nalbuphine to manage the opioid-induced pruritus.
Nalbuphine is a smart addition there. The paper notes it's an effective approach for managing pruritus without diminishing the postoperative pain relief or increasing sedation at smaller doses. It's a tool we should probably keep in mind when using ITM.
I found the technical description of the ESPB in the paper quite useful for our residents. They used a high-frequency linear US transducer placed in a longitudinal orientation over the transverse process. The local anesthetic was injected into the fascial plane deep to the erector spinae muscle, allowing for that craniocaudal distribution that relieves both somatic and visceral pain.
It's an elegant technique, especially for centers that have the ultrasound equipment and the expertise. However, the study does acknowledge a reality for many. The lack of availability of US machines in low-resource settings can limit the use of ESPB. In those cases, ITM becomes a very attractive, cost-effective alternative, provided you're prepared to manage the itching and nausea.
So, Dr. Aris, as a senior attending, how do you weigh these results? If you have a patient undergoing a 3-level fusion tomorrow, which are you leaning towards based on this data?
It's about the balance of efficacy versus side effects. This study tells us that 0.2 milligrams of ITM is the winner for pure pain control and reducing rescue meds over 24 hours. If I have a patient who is very sensitive to pain or has a high opioid tolerance, ITM might be the way to go. But if I have a patient who is highly susceptible to postoperative nausea and vomiting, which can itself delay discharge and cause distress, the ESPB offers a very respectable level of analgesia with a much cleaner recovery profile.
And it's worth noting, the authors concluded that while ITM provided lower pain scores and demands, the side effects are a real factor. The ESPB is safer and easier to apply in many contexts.
Exactly. Let's talk about the primary outcome again, the time to first rescue analgesic. Why is that such a focus in these trials?
Because it's a direct proxy for the quality of the immediate postoperative transition. If a patient is comfortable for the first 6 to 12 hours without needing systemic NSAIDs or additional opioids, they are more likely to participate in early mobilization. In this study, both E and M groups were significantly superior to the control, meaning both techniques are viable tools for an ERAS pathway.
One thing for the residents to keep in mind is the hydrophilic nature of morphine mentioned in the background. Because it has lower clearance from the cerebral spinal fluid, it stays active. This is why we see that 24-hour window of efficacy, but that same property is why it can migrate cranially and cause that delayed respiratory depression if the dose is too high. This study reinforces that 0.2 milligrams is a relatively safe and effective dose in this population.
The study also touched on the economic side. While they didn't do a full formal cost analysis, they mentioned that inadequate pain relief increases healthcare costs through extended length of stay. By choosing either of these regional techniques over standard systemic analgesic, we're likely saving the system money and improving the patient experience.
It's a great reminder that our job doesn't end when the last skin staple goes in. The first 24 hours are just as critical for the surgical outcome as the decompression itself.
Absolutely. To summarize for our listeners, this randomized controlled trial showed that for elective lumbar fusion, 0.2 milligrams of intrathecal morphine provides superior analgesia and less rescue medication than the erector spinae plane block, but it does so at the cost of increased nausea and pruritus. Both, however, are vastly superior to standard general anesthesia alone.
Well said, Alara. This is definitely a paper to keep in the folder for the next time we're refining our institutional protocols.
It really highlights the move toward a multimodal, opioid-sparing approach in spine surgery.
That's all the time we have for today's deep dive. Thank you for joining us on the Neurosurgery Hub podcast. I'm Dr. Aris.
And I'm Dr. Alara. We'll see you in the next episode.
Keep learning and keep operating.